problem of professionals who are presumed incompetent.
There's a culture of silence. These things are simply not discussed, which means that they continue over and over and over again.
There is an entire group of qualified educators who constantly battle the perception that they're not good teachers. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. What if you went to work every day knowing you would be presumed incompetent? According to the book Presumed Incompetent, The Intersections of Race and Class for Women of Color in Academia, that's the reality for minority women teaching at the college level. They've reached the ivory tower, the professional world where ability and achievement are rewarded with tenure, a secure, well-paying job, but they aren't likely to get in. The book is a combination of studies and essays offering statistical data and personal experience to back up the assertion that minority women face quiet, and sometimes not so quiet, discrimination on the job, not just from their peers and college administrators, but from their students. It's not a huge population. Women of color held only 10% of instructor positions at U.S. colleges 6 years ago, and the numbers decline as you go up the academic ranks. Carmen Gonzalez, a professor of law at Seattle University School of Law, is one of the editors of Presumed Incompetent. I spoke with her about the barriers faced by minority women pursuing an academic career.
Just by the response we received from the call for papers, we knew that we had struck a nerve. This is the experience. Women are outraged that it's happening, and they want to talk about it. They want to write about it. Because what happens in academia is that there's a culture of silence. These things are simply not discussed, which means that they continue over and over and over again.
So, Carmen, share with me a couple of the stories from this book, these essays that these women have written.
One of the themes that emerges from the book is the incredible power that unconscious stereotypes wield. The dominant image that we have of the professor is white and male. This is particularly true in the natural sciences, in business, in math, but in many other fields as well, including fields that are dominated by women. And what that means is that when colleagues and students see a woman of color in front of the room, they automatically and often unconsciously presume that she's not as well qualified, not as capable, not as well credentialed. And this translates into behavior. Microaggressions is the term that's used, daily insults that wear women down. So let me give you an example. One of the essays in the book is a study that was done of 193 Latinas who are graduate students or junior faculty in political science. So we're not talking about 5 women or 10 women, 193. And what nearly 60% of them reported is that their colleagues immediately pigeonholed them as race and gender experts and couldn't take them seriously when it came to the areas that they actually write about and have had extensive intellectual training in. Their credentials, their qualifications were constantly questioned. But the flip side is that if they were race and gender experts, then their work wasn't considered real scholarship. Many colleagues thought that they couldn't be objective in teaching those areas. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't.
And what kind of hurdles do they run into with the administration at these schools?
The major hurdle, there's so many. The one major hurdle is lack of mentoring. And that's a big one. Because what makes academia so different from other areas, other occupations, is that the standards, the expectations are extraordinarily vague and unspoken, and when they're written down in the most ambiguous terms. And so mentoring then becomes crucial. That's how you learn about the codes of behavior. That's how you learn about what this opaque language really means. And studies have shown that women generally, but women of color in particular, receive less mentoring than their white male counterparts. And again, given the steep learning curve, this is absolutely essential. One of the most one of the studies in the book talks about students who were preparing for careers in STEM fields, in science, technology, engineering, and math. And it highlighted some of the reasons for this lack of mentoring in this particular area, although it runs throughout various disciplines. And one of the things this study showed is that there were lower expectations of women of color. There was this presumption that few of them would really stick with it because there were so few in this area anyway. There was also this belief that women of color were admitted only because of affirmative action, so that professors and administrators expressed surprise when women were successful. It's similar to the way some people express surprise that President Obama is so articulate. It suggests you are a credit to your race and an exception. And then the other thing that this particular study found is that professors often fail to exercise any form of self-censorship in terms of making offensive, racist and sexist comments because they viewed the women as invisible, as women who would drop out and therefore would not really be their colleagues in the long run. The patterns that emerge are about a systemic problem.
Another thing I found disturbing was that if minority women look to other women for assistance or even understanding, they often don't find it.
And that's a huge issue because when you think about what the solutions are to the dilemmas that I described, to the patterns that I described, they're not individual, they're collective. Collective struggle is the solution because these are institutional patterns. And so the ability to form alliances across identity categories with white women, with men of color, with white men who care deeply about issues of equity and justice is crucial. But in order to form those alliances, what's necessary is for people to recognize their own relative privilege, because we are all privileged in different ways. It may be because we're able-bodied, it could be class background, it could be race, it could be gender, but unless that privilege is acknowledged, and the position of others who are not so privileged is also acknowledged, there's no possibility to really work along those lines. And one of the difficulties many women identified is female colleagues who just saw the gender issue but didn't see the intersection of gender and race and how that made the situation different.
And I'm sure this is a problem that is not discussed publicly usually, because if you are in the academic world, rocking the boat is a way to guarantee you will no longer be in the academic world.
Absolutely. There is a penalty to be paid, and it can be a very severe one, for being the squeaky wheel, for being the person that exposes these problems. And as a consequence of that, the discussion of these issues often happens behind closed doors, if at all. And very often when a woman is experiencing challenges from her colleagues, hostility from her students, it's very easy to assume that it's her fault, that she's the only one who's experiencing this, because the problems are not widely discussed. And what this means is that for many women, this could be utterly career-threatening, because others who are in the position of looking at their teaching evaluations, for example, might not understand that these patterns have been documented. In fact, one of my favorite essays in Presumed Incompetent takes the literature that exists in a variety of disciplines on race and gender bias in student teaching evaluations and compiles it, pulls it all together so that someone who wants to just take a look at one piece with many citations in case they want to read more can look at it. But generally, faculty aren't aware of it, and the patterns are really stark. The patterns show that white women and people of color generally receive lower teaching evaluations than white men. And women of color often receive the lowest because they're the furthest removed from the white male norm. But what's interesting is it's certain women of color and certain white women receive the lowest evaluations of all. And it's those who defy stereotypical expectations. Students expect women to be nurturing. This expectation is particularly strong with a black female professor who they would like to see in the role of mammy, or a Latina, where students are influenced by cultural stereotypes of Latinas as maids and nannies. And so when the woman performs in a way that is contrary to that stereotype, when she's demanding, when she is tough, that's when the students give her the lowest evaluations of all. And that means that she has to remain very calm as they constantly challenge her competence, challenge everything she says, become enraged if they receive a low grade in her class. Because professors who demonstrate anger and frustration when these things happen are also penalized in student teaching evaluations. And the problem is that often faculty who sit on tenure and promotion committees who are white men, this doesn't happen to them. So they must assume that the professor is doing something wrong. I get emails and phone calls from women I have never met who are going through hell in the workplace and just need someone to talk to, including one woman who was denied tenure and was appealing her tenure denial. And this was an amazing story. The book was hugely significant to her because she was so ashamed. She thought she was the only person who had ever gone through this. And she felt that way because women don't talk about this. When she started beating the bushes in her discipline, she found that at least five of the luminaries in her field had been denied tenure. But this wasn't public information. And that's what gave her the courage to say, no, I'm going to fight this. I'm going to fight this because I can point to the irregularities, I can point to the literature that supports some of the things that I'm saying, and I know that I've done what I need to do to earn tenure. To the extent that women of color continue to be underrepresented and marginalized, we're not preparing our students to deal with a world that is increasingly diverse. But the situation is getting worse with the corporatization of higher education. As public investment in higher education declines, universities are under increasing pressure to adopt a corporate for-profit model. They're relying on part-time and adjunct faculty for instruction and reducing the number of tenure-track faculty. And the studies show that women of color are disproportionately represented in the ranks of the part-time faculty and underrepresented in the ranks of the tenure. So just as more and more women of color are getting advanced degrees and are ready to move into academia, those positions, those permanent positions, are closing down. So this is a trend that I think everyone should be watching, because when higher education declines, the nation declines with it.
The book is Presumed Incompetent, The Intersection of Race and Class for Women of Color in Academia. Carmen Gonzalez is a professor of law at Seattle University School of Law. Coming up, more on women who refuse to stay inside the box. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1242. Stereotypes. They're a way to limit us, to tell us there's something we're not supposed to do. Stereotypes have discouraged girls from studying math and science. It's perpetuated the myth that women are only suited for jobs that involve nurturing and service. Producer Clay Scott brings us the story of a young single mother from Montana who has become a game warden and discovered a talent for busting poachers and stereotypes.
Quinn Kuka is a single mother of two girls. She's also an artist. She's waited tables, worked in highway construction, and worked as a ranch hand. In her spare time, she likes to read books on psychology. All of that comes in handy for her job as a Montana State game warden.
I'm 30 years old. I became a warden when I was 27, and I had just graduated from the Salish Kootenai College with my fisheries and wildlife degree, and I was kind of lost. I knew I wanted to have a job in the fish and game department, but I couldn't figure out where my personality was best suited. Law enforcement to me was the perfect fit for my personality. Here, as a game warden, you think, oh, you have to be this great hunter and this great fisherman, and what it really is you have to be great with people. You have to help them sort out a bad situation and remain calm. And so I kind of find it easy And plus, I love people, so I'm always seeking them out and want to hear a great story. Right now, we're at Pruitt Creek Fishing Access Site and Campground, and a lot of people will put their drift boats in here. I always do the friendly wave, so they know I'm nice.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing good. Hey!
How was
Birdie.
The fishing?
Hey, well, we're just getting ready to get started.
Oh, you're just leaving.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come on, Birdie. Come on.
Are you just two of you today?
Yeah, just
okay.
Me and my wife.
I'm okay. She must be the one by the camper. Is she the, or is she shuttling down?
No, she's shuttling down
Pelican.
Okay.
Quinn's job description is pretty varied. She's been called on to pull drowning victims from the water, put down injured wildlife, spend freezing nights in the backcountry, and arrest armed poachers. The overcast morning I spent patrolling with her was pretty slow, so we had a chance to sit by the Missouri for half an hour while sandhill cranes and red-tailed hawks flew overhead.
I don't take being a single mother of my two daughters as a burden. It's more of a... It's always constantly, it's a drive, it pushes me forward. I remember the first time I ever killed a deer, I had my she was about seven at the time, I think, in hand, and my baby was 9 months on my backpack, and we all killed my first deer together. Yeah, when I was stationed in Conrad, when I first got there, the boundary of the Blackfeet Reservation bordered my district, and then I actually had to pass through the Blackfeet Reservation to get around to my west side of my district. So oftentimes you're going through the reservation. I'd stopped in and I had met with the fishing game and introduced there.
With the tribal fishing game.
With the tribal fishing game, yep. And the tribal fishing game director. And so every time I go by there, I go by, you know, where I grew up, my uncle's place, my grandpa's place, you know, where we have our Easter egg hunts, and I'd stop in and see my uncle on my way through the reservation. Before I got there, you know, the state game wardens weren't really accepted, and they weren't allowed on sometimes, and there was no relationship other than they didn't have one. And now it's almost like we're all a team up there. There's boundaries, but it doesn't seem like it. There was actually an incident where there was about a couple of guys. At the time, I only thought there was one, but it turns out there was five of them. And they were hiding in the brush from me, and one of them had stopped, and he put his hands up. He said, "Okay, you got me, you got me." And I didn't even know he was there. He was in camouflage, and he was probably a 6'5". He turns out to be one of the nicest guys. I'll never forget him. His name is Eli. And I've had a lot of people who've been in trouble before, and I've seen their lives change because of that one thing. I'll see them in public, and I'll see them at a new job, and they're like, you know, thanks for, wrote them a ticket, and they're like, thanks for that, because it changed me, you know? So that's my number one goal right now, is to change the face of the game warden, one contact at a time. Well, I'm just out checking fishing license. You probably have yours all packed away nicely.
No, no, I think I got it real handy.
If you don't mind, I'll take a peek.
No problem. It's the first time this year.
That story comes to us courtesy Mountain West Voices. And finally, Gilles Malkin as another stereotype-busting woman. She is considered one of the best all-round athletes there ever was. And she was the first woman to challenge the men on their own green.
Born of Norwegian immigrant parents in Port Arthur, Texas, on June 26, 1911, Mildred Ella Didrikson, the quintessential tomboy, was not only an athlete that amazed all who saw her perform, she was so dedicated an athlete that her excellence applied to every sport she tried. She may well have been the greatest all-around athlete ever. According to her, the only thing she didn't play was dolls. She eventually focused on golf and developed such a shining and phenomenal personal achievement in it that she's now considered to be in a class of her own. The Associated Press named her as the female athlete of the year once for track and field and five times for golf, for which she became most famous. And in 1999, they named her the ninth greatest athlete of the 20th century. So, at age 21, in 1932, when she competed in the Amateur Athletic Union Games, which also served as a qualifying platform for the Olympics, what could she do? Throw the javelin? Okay. Run the 8-meter hurdles? All right. Do the high jump? Yes. Throw a baseball? That used to be a track event. Okay, yeah. How about setting new world records in each of those in a single day? And although she was the only member on her team that day, she also won the team championship, accumulating more points than the second place team that had 22 members. Babe Didrikson also won two Olympic gold medals and one silver that same year in 1932 at the Los Angeles Olympics. She was qualified to do five events, but women were only allowed to compete in three. Babe Didrikson was the ultimate competitor. Very rarely in human history has any athlete of either gender achieved excellence in so many sports. She'd first played basketball on a team called the Golden Cyclones, which her employer sponsored. She earned All-American status in 1930, 31, and 32. She was tough, she was brash, she talked trash, and completely intimidated her competition. Finally, it was at golf that she excelled. Do you play golf seriously? If so, do you hit 1,500 balls a day at practice? At 145 pounds, Babe Didrikson could average a 250-yard drive, and remember, this was 75 years ago. Bobby Jones himself said she was one of the greatest players ever, male or female. By the way, she was also an excellent seamstress and made her golf outfits herself. No way could she be ignored. In 1946 and 1947, she won 14 consecutive tournaments and a total of 17, a record that's never been equaled. Then, she turned pro. By 1951, she was earning $100,000 a year for her endorsements, ads, and exhibitions. She was often seen in glitz matches with the likes of Johnny Weissmuller, Bing Crosby, Mickey Rooney, Bob Hope, and the other babe, Ruth. From 1950 to 1955, she competed in 67 LPGA events, finishing first in 21 of them. She was a founding member and the second president of the LPGA. She was the first on many fronts, first American woman to win the premier European golf tournament for women, the British Women's Amateur Championship, and the first to win both the American and British in 1 year, the first woman to win the Western Women's Open three times, and the only woman ever to qualify for the Los Angeles Open, a men's only tournament. Her total wins and accomplishments are far too numerous to list here. Including amateur and pro, Babe won 82 golf tournaments in her life. In 1953, at age 42, Babe Didrikson underwent surgery for colon cancer and was told she would live, but her athletic career was certainly over. In 1954, she won the U.S. Women's Open by 12 strokes with a colostomy bag strapped to her body. But the disease eventually caught up to her, and she died at 45 in 1956. I would encourage anyone who appreciates form in sports to look up old videos of Babe Didrikson swinging a golf club. You will be amazed at what you see. Grantland Rice, known as the Dean of American Sports Writers, said of her, "She's beyond all belief until you see her perform. Then you finally understand that you're looking at the most flawless section of muscle harmony, of complete mental and physical coordination the world of sport has ever seen." Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer, actor, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.